How's it going, everybody? These are the worst date movies ever. My name is Greg Knox, and hey, guess what? It's nearly Valentine's Day, and why not use Valentine's Day to watch a really, really inappropriate movie like the one that we're going to talk about on the show today? I am joined once again by the managing director of the Triptych Art Gallery. It's Miroslava Hartmund.
Hello.
Cool. So, Miroslava, have you had any bad experiences on Valentine's Day that you wanted to share with the listeners?
Well, actually, in preparation for this Valentine's Day special, I tried to recall an actual Valentine's Day that I spent with someone special, and I couldn't. So that just gives you a clue there, doesn't it? However, I did recall two really embarrassing stories related to inappropriate Valentine's Day cards. So I'm just going to share them with you now. So the first Valentine's card that I ever got in my life was when I was 11, and oh, wow. I brought home a Valentine's Day card and showed it to my dad, and it said, "I know it sounds corny, but you make me horny." And it had like a, it was hand drawn, and the name. So it was like dear, and then the name was scribbled out, and then somebody put Miro. So I clearly wasn't the first choice. Also, I had no idea what horny meant at that point. I think my father did. And there was also like a horny devil on the front. It wasn't a good setup. And the second time that a Valentine's card involved me in a nightmare scenario was when I got a Valentine's Day card from a mystery admirer. It just said X in blue ink. And I think I was about 14, and I was actually really intrigued. I was like, who is this? It turned out a couple of years down the line that it was from one of my school friends' fathers.
Oh, dear.
I know.
Well, there you go, everyone. So now you know what to get Miro for Valentine's Day. So really inappropriate Valentine's cards with horny devils on them.
You can post them to the Triptych Gallery in Kiev, 34 Andriyevsky Uzviz. Flowers also welcome.
Oh, just there you saying. Go. Awesome.
What about you, Greg?
Well, as I was telling you off air, I've only ever really had a relationship over one Valentine's Day only in my life. Yes, I am that sort of, that much of a catch. So basically,
you're selective.
Yes, I am. I'm incredibly selective. I'm a man of taste and refinery, goddammit.
And finery.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really do an awful lot for Valentine's Day. This is years ago. My memory is not great. All I remember is I went to the local Sainsbury's and I bought a bunch of flowers and I bought some grapes.
Smooth.
Because she wanted grapes.
Grapes?
It wasn't my choice.
Was she a human, this Valentine of yours? It sounds like something you would buy for a pet, a horse maybe, or a pony.
It was what she wanted, and I can
she
assure
wanted
you,
grapes.
I you know, I did.
Seedless? Were they seedless?
They were definitely seedless, yes. They were probably genetically modified as well.
Oh dear.
Oh dear. So yeah, so I don't have a great deal of experience on Valentine's Day itself, although I do have a very funny date story sort of relating to the show as such. So in Wallington, where myself and Miroslava used to live, there was a video Woo! Store called Apollo Video. Do you remember it?
I actually do, by the station, right?
Yes, it was right by Wallington Station, and it was my very, very first girlfriend, and what we did is we were bored one day, so she was like, let's go rent a movie. So we rented a movie, and not wishing to cast gender aspersions, but she didn't really know what she wanted to watch, so she left the choice to me. And I'm quite a picky soul, even back then when it comes to films, so what I decided to get was Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Oh, nice one. Yeah.
As you do. So yes, that'll do it. That's what we watched. Now, it would be normally a very, very bad date movie, but I can't say it had any ill effect because I don't remember her being massively offended or turned off or anything like that. So it worked quite well. So there you go. With all these things, it's all about the context and it's also about the person
you're
with.
Was she still in the room?
Yeah, she watched it with me.
Okay. You're sure about that? She didn't just leave halfway through and you didn't realise because you were so absorbed in the drama.
No, she was definitely still there. She might have fallen asleep at one point, but wow. Again, this was about 15 years ago. You know, I'm quite old, everybody, so.
So, how old are you now?
I'm 35.
That's a good age for a man.
Oh, is it now? Okay.
Yeah, your best years are ahead of you. So, here's to many more Valentine's Days with actual human companions.
Yes, and not people who want grapes.
No. Or razor blades.
And on that note, because these are the worst date movies ever, what I would like to say, first of all, is that if, you know, this is episode number 10, everybody, so I have 9 previous episodes, and if you want to check any of those out, you can do so in the usual places, i.e. iTunes, YouTube, Spotify, etc. So, the reason I've got Miroslava on the show today is to talk about a very, very... well, possibly bad movie to watch this Valentine's Day.
It's so bad.
Oh, well, we're going to go into this when we talk about the film in more detail. It's by that notorious sort of European art house director, possibly sort of provocateur himself, is Michael Haneke. And it's The Piano Teacher, which came out in 2001. Now, have you seen any of Haneke's other films?
I have not. This is my first Haneke film.
Cool. So in that case, what I thought I'd do, because I've actually seen quite a few of his films, is maybe I can kind of contextualise the film that we're about to talk about. So Michael Haneke was born in Germany, but he was mostly known as an Austrian, because I think that's where he spent most of his life. Now, he's been making films since the late 80s. He's released, in my opinion, sort of one great film pretty much every decade since the 80s. So his first three films form what's called the Glaciation Trilogy, and they are Seventh Continent, which is definitely a very bad date movie. It's about a family, a sort of upper middle class family, who they go about their daily lives and then one day basically decide to destroy everything in their house and then they all commit suicide.
Okay, that sounds almost like a Japanese family film.
Possibly. He also released Benny's Video, which is quite messed up, and a film with a very, very strange name that I'm probably going to get one. So it's 71 Fragments of a Chronology of Chance, which is like an anthology-type film. He's done a couple of those. And after that, he released probably, maybe not now, but for what was a long time, his most famous film, Funny Games, which is a very, very divisive film. Funny Games is a film you either really get or you don't get. It's as simple as that. And after that, he moved to France because, one, the Austrian film industry, he wasn't able to raise the funds that he wanted. But also, Juliette Binoche really wanted to do a film with him. So, as you would do in that circumstance, he did decide to make a film. So he moved to France.
That's a good reason to move to France.
Yes, is a very, very, very good reason. And he made a film called Code Unknown, which again is sort of like a Altman-esque sort of film with many different stories going on at the same time. And then he made this film, which we're going to talk about now, The Piano Teacher. And then he's made sort of other great films. So he made a film called Cachet, which is really, really good. And he's made two films that won the Palme d'Or. So one's The White Ribbon, which is really good, which is actually probably my favourite Haneke film. And then a film called Amour, which not only won the Palme d'Or, also won the Best Foreign Language Oscar at that year's ceremony.
And that also has Isabelle Huppert, who is in Le Pianiste, The Piano Teacher, right?
Yes, so Isabelle Huppert, who plays the main character in this, she has also appeared in other Haneke films. So she appeared in Amour. She appeared in a film called Time with the Wolf, which is a lot less good Haneke. Still kind of quite good, but yeah, not upper echelon. And his most recent film, Happy End, she is the main character in that film as well.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So what is a Michael Haneke film? So what traits do Michael Haneke films typically have? Well, he's been compared most to Robert Bresson and sort of Carl Fyodor Dreyer and sort of Tarkovsky and directors like that. So his films are typically quite austere. Would you agree?
This film is definitely austere, both in its subject matter and its style.
Yes. So what Haneke is sort of most well known for is he does like sort of tracking shots and stuff like that, but his camera typically doesn't really move very much. He's more interested mm-hmm. in the framing as such mm-hmm. that goes on within each shot itself. And he does utilize a lot of long takes. I mean, The Piano Teacher alone, there's one take that's about 8 minutes long, which happens about two thirds of the way into the film, which is really, really, really good, which kind of is where sort of Tarkovsky kind of comparisons come from. But yes, mostly the camera work is quite static. And what he also does, and this is kind of what he's most known for the most, is that he's a provocateur, but he's not a provocateur in the way that sort of Gaspar Noé or Lars von Trier are. What he'll do is he'll have these uncomfortable situations happen on the frame, but they're not gratuitous necessarily. It's just they're very, very uncomfortable because the camera, because it doesn't move away. It's just very unflinching.
How dare you call Gaspar Noé gratuitous? No.
That's not exactly what I had in mind. in exploitation cinema, for example, so you do have a lot of these sort of films where it will show you everything, warts and all. Whereas in these types of films, there's a scene in this film which involves self-mutilation of a particular part of the body. Now,
the female body.
Yes. Yes, very much so. Now, other directors, what they'll do is they'll take the opportunity to kind of show you that in great graphic, sort of close-up detail, whereas Haneke sort of shoots it from sort of a middle distance. So it's clear what's going on, but it's partly up to your imagination, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he accentuates the violence with seeping blood, with like the movement of blood either through fabric or along the protagonist or, you know, down the antagonist's leg. But certainly you don't really see much genitalia in this film.
No.
Relating exactly. to the actual characters.
No. And what his style does is it forces the viewer almost to become like a participant in the film itself. Now, this film, maybe not so much, but in Funny Games and Cachet, definitely, because of the way those films were put together, I mean, particularly in Funny Games, you've got fourth wall breaking, so you've got characters talking to the audience saying, oh, you know, do you think people will live, and things like that. And in Cachet, they use a really, really clever narrative device where you've got shots which are static and that you think are happening in the moment, but are actually recordings that the other characters are watching and then commenting on, things like that. So, again, that works really well. Again, not so much in this, but it's something that Haneke does really, really well. Also, talking about kind of the way the films put together themselves, generally his films don't have scores because mm-hmm. one of Haneke's big things is that he doesn't like to emotionally manipulate his audience. So he likes things to be sort of quite naturalistic. So, and he doesn't really use stuff like exposition or flashbacks. He kind of leaves characters sort of in the moment, and it's for you as an audience member to kind of work out what's going on with them. You're not really spoon-fed information about the characters.
Absolutely. And on that, I mean, firstly, that relates to what you said about him being quite austere. You don't really see or hear much more than you absolutely need to, or much more than you would see if you were in the room. You know, it's very naturalistic, both in terms of the framing, a lot of kind of mid-length shots, or some of the framing is from a distance, from the kind of distance that you would, you know, realistically be at if you were watching one of the characters, like in real life. So it does have a sort of, it has quite a clever, almost voyeuristic quality to it, in that sense. And although I haven't seen any other Haneke films, I did read a little bit about The Piano Teacher. And one thing that's clear to me is that it's certainly among the more musical of Haneke's films. There's a lot of external diegetic sound in the form of music performance, because a lot of the characters are either professional musicians or they're students of music at the Vienna Conservatoire. We do hear a lot of music being played, but it's not a soundtrack. It is actually being performed. And Haneke kind of plays with that idea of, oh, it's a film, you expect to see music, when he sort of cuts, like finally cuts to the title of the film about 3 minutes into the film. And the credits are intercut with edits of different hands performing different pieces. So we have Haydn, we have Chopin, we have a bit of Erika, the main character's favorite, Schubert and Schumann. And of course, we immediately, that maps onto what we know credits to be like. But throughout the rest of the film, there is no gratuitous soundtrack or scoring or anything like that. All the music that we hear is music that we see being performed, or that we know to be performed in the distance, in the background, as in the famous toilet standoff between Erika and Walter, which takes place while everybody else is at the rehearsal. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would actually, yeah. So it's quite interesting that you talk about voyeurism. So you mentioned that earlier. And yeah, Cachet is definitely a film about voyeurism. That's the whole point of the film, really, is about that.
Mm-hmm.
Although, interestingly, and Cachet and this are actually good examples. One of mentioned Funny Games as well. One of the things that he likes to do is he sees himself as like the anti-Tarantino. So what he'll do is he'll take like a genre of film. So for example, like in Cachet, it's thriller. This film is like a romantic melodrama. And in Funny Games, it's a horror film. And what he'll do is he'll take the tropes and he'll kind of completely invert them and make them almost like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the best way to explain it, but it's almost like if you watch his films as a genre fan, a lot of genre fans take, I don't know, they just don't like Haneke's films, particularly Funny Games. Funny Games provokes a lot of interesting reactions in people because of how that film works, because it's taking these tropes that exist in like horror, for example. So if you're watching like a home invasion film, which is basically what Funny Games is, it does a lot of things that those films don't normally do, and people, just because they're expecting like easy resolutions, that was the last thing I was going to say, is a typical Haneke trope in his films, is that his films don't have easy endings. So a lot of his films end either in what would be sort of non-conventional or just very ambiguous ways. So Hidden, so Cachet is a good example of that, because the ending of that film, I won't spoil it in case you want to watch it, but yeah,
I do want to watch it, don't spoil it.
I'm not going to spoil it, but it ends in a very, very ambiguous way, where the ending could be one thing or it could be another thing altogether, and it won't tell you what it is. It's for you to kind of decide. And The Piano Teacher is actually quite similar in that the way it ends, it could go again a couple of different ways depending on your point of view.
Yeah, certainly the there is a lack of moral clarity in The Piano Teacher.
Yeah, which I think is deliberate.
It probably is. I have a quote here from Haneke. I have two quotes from Haneke, which I hope to share during our conversation. And it seems appropriate to share the first one now. So, according to Haneke, His films are intended as polemical statements against the American barrel-down cinema and its disempowerment of the spectator. They are an appeal for a cinema of insistent questions instead of force, because too quick, answers, for clarifying distance in place of violating closeness, for provocation and dialogue instead of consumption and consensus. So I think this speaks to what you said about him being a provocateur, and then, you know, also him not really giving us easy answers and leaving room for a lot of ambiguity that messes with our consumer mentality when it comes to films.
Yeah, so for example, like I mentioned earlier, sort of a lack of a score, a lack of exposition, lack of sort of explanations as to why characters are doing what they're doing, lack of backstory, things like that. So the main character in this film, we're not entirely sure why she is the way she is. It's possible there's a couple of nuggets in there. Like, for example,
should we outline the story for those who haven't seen it and who might be watching it on a date soon?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I suppose just to give you a quick introduction to the film itself. So Piano Teacher, as I mentioned earlier, it was released in 2001. It's interestingly the first film that Haneke made. It might possibly be the only one which he didn't directly write himself. It's based on a novel by Elfriede Jelinek, also called The Piano Teacher. And the story is basically the same. There's a couple of things that Haneke didn't sort of use in the story. So, for example, in the book, there are flashbacks which kind of tell you a bit more about why the main character does what she does. But instead, in the film, those are kind of, I guess, put upon other characters, which we'll go into in a minute. And it does star Isabelle Huppert as the main character. Also stars Annie Girardot as her mother. Literally, that's just the name of the character, is the mother. Benoit Magimel as Walter Clemmer, who is obviously the main male character in the film. And interestingly for Haneke fans, the mother of a student of the main character is played by Suzanne Lothar, who is the mother from Funny Games as well. So they're in the film. And the cinematography, which is awesome, as it is in pretty much all of Haneke's films, is done by Christian Berger in this film. Berger is Haneke's main cinematographer. He has used other cinematographers, but he does seem to use Berger the most. In fact, he was the cinematographer on Benny's Video, which is his second film, and on Happy End, which is his most recent film. So, Miro, what is the story of The Piano Teacher?
Well, the story of the... What is the story of The Piano Teacher? Well, I think it's important to start with the title, because in English it's been translated as The Piano Teacher, but the original novel by Elfriede Jelinek is Die Klavierspielerin, and the title of the film in French is La Pianiste. So both the German and the French title means piano, the piano player female, so the female piano player. And that gives us some indication that, well, that it's probably referring to the main character, namely Erica Cote. But whereas the English focuses on the teaching aspect of the main character, the German and the French title is more ambiguous, and it is sort of the mother and daughter relationship that suggests that Erica has a background in performing, or perhaps that she didn't quite make it as a piano player and a performer, despite being well respected as a professor of music and a teacher of music at the Vienna Music Conservatory. So it follows the life of a woman who is in her 40s, who lives with her mother. We know that her father is in a psychiatric asylum, and in fact, he dies off screen quite early on in the film. So Erica is quite cold, distant, quite snappy, sort of keeps herself to herself. She's very cold, and at a recital hosted by kind of almost stereotypically bourgeois family, she meets the young Walter Klemmer, the nephew of the host, who is a handsome young man. He is played by Benoît Magimel, and I think he got an award for the role, as well as Isabelle Huppert. They were both awarded Best Actor and Best Actress, is that right?
Yeah, so it was at the Cannes Film Festival when the year that this came out. So, yeah, they both won Best Actor and Best Actress, respectively, and the film won the Grand Prix, which is, in effect, like the second prize at Cannes.
So two very strong lead performances. So Walter is much younger than Erica, and he starts to pursue her. And the fact that he's quite handsome makes his advances towards Erica, makes them romantic, I guess, makes them quite endearing, but not ridiculous. If, you know, in the same way that there would have been if he looked, you know, younger or was less conventionally handsome. And he enrolls at the music conservatory where Erica is teaching and displays his considerable talent during an examination. And in fact, everything that he does, just after their initial meeting, is very, again, very much control, you know, conforms to these bourgeois tropes of what, you know, a man from the intelligentsia, from the kind of privileged upper class, would do to woo a woman. And Erica is completely impervious. First and foremost, she's not pleased to see him auditioning for the Vienna Music Conservatory. She votes against him, even though her colleagues are very impressed by his evident and considerable talent. She treats him, you know, in a very cold and distant manner, and just she won't have any of it. But gradually, the tension between them becomes palpable, and after they kiss in a toilet during a rehearsal, she starts to sort of twist the relationship. I mean, it's already a bit twisted because technically she is his teacher, but she tries to assert power, and she kind of chips away at the innocence of his romantic love for her through gradually revealing her quite, you know, masochistic, violent sexual needs. And in doing so, she sort of robs him of his innocence because he becomes increasingly frustrated, increasingly cruel and disgusted with both her and himself in the process of engagement. And of course, while all this is going on, her mother, whom she lives with, is just absolutely relentless, and she is, you know, probably a major antagonist of this film. And a lot of the critique around both the original novel and the film centered on the mother-daughter relationship, which gives it, I mean, to me, although I have yet to see Haneke's other films, it very clearly evoked several films by other directors. So Isabelle Huppert's performance really reminded me of her recent one in Elle, which is also a psychosexual drama that looks at, you know, abuse and sadomasochism and kind of role reversals. And also the setting of the music conservatory and piano performance setting reminded me of a film called The Page Turner. Have you seen that one?
No, I mean, I've seen Elle. And Elle's a really good film by Paul Verhoeven, which is quite random that he brought that out so long after he's made a really good film. But yeah, I haven't seen The Page Turner.
Well, it's It's sort of like a, you know, a French indie film from the mid 2000s by Denis Dercourt. I haven't seen any of his other films, but it's a revenge story. So it's about a promising pianist, a child, that basically fails her exam very early on because of a well-known pianist who walks into the room just as she is performing, and she distracts both the judges and the girl. And it's basically about how, you know, revenge is a dish best served cold, how she sort of gradually avenges her failure. And it's, you know, it's this kind of parlor room drama, and a lot of the piano player takes place in either the conservatoire, you know, in a practice room, or the performance hall, or in Erica and her mother's home. So a lot of the kind of language that is used is a lot of talk of cages and caged animals. Like when she come the very first scene, she refers to her practice room as a cage to her mother. And there's a lot of quite kind of bestial imagery. We in the Schubert piece, in the vocal piece that is performed, you know, dogs are barking, rattling their chains. You know, we talk about dogs. There's mention of pigs. We see horses. Do you remember the Mustang program? Yes. On TV?
It's very, very random.
It seems random, but, you know, horses, they're domesticated animals that are subdued in order to serve humans.
But as in all these kind of films, there is a reason for it to be there, like you said.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So this, you know, the frame of the shot acts as a kind of cage for our characters. So the page turner is definitely one. Another one is, you know, definitely like the work of Lars von Trier. And here, you know, the genital mutilation is, you know, obviously evokes disturbing memories of Antichrist.
I love Antichrist.
And also Nymphomaniac, which is, you know, all about women's dark, twisted desires. So definitely a lot of parallels to be drawn between those two films. Well, actually, you've seen Elle. So how do you feel Isabel Huppert's performance in The Piano Teacher refers to, corresponds, you know, with some of her other memorable performances?
Yeah, so I've got to be honest, I'm not a massive sort of expert on Isabel Huppert. I haven't seen her in that many films. The only films I've seen of hers are this, Elle, a sort of film by Claire Denis called White Material, but that was a very, very long time ago. And, I mean, she does appear in Haneke's other films, like I mentioned earlier, but they're not in this kind of role. I think how this compares to Elle, I guess, is I think Elle is like a less extreme version of the character that she plays in this film, really, because there's a lot more...
Because she's not living with her mother, so...
Well, no, that is very true, but I was going to say, I think the character in this film has a lot more depth to the one that she has in Elle, because there's so much going on. I think you said a lot there, I've got to be honest, there's a lot for me to unpack, but... The way I look at the film is maybe slightly different to the way that you said. So what you've got is you've got this very, very strange relationship between mother and daughter, where the daughter is essentially still being treated as a child. So she's very, very much being infantilized by the mother, to the point where they even sleep in the same bed, pretty much, or they sleep in beds right next to each other, in effect. Which is
not because there's no room in the house. It looks like quite a spacious apartment, doesn't it?
Yeah, Erica even has her own room with a bed in it, where she has all her porn and her bondage gear and shit sort of underneath. So it's not that she doesn't have another room that she can sleep in as such. It's more that, I don't know, and again, this isn't really explained, like the relationship between her and her father, because as I was going to mention earlier, one of the things that she does sort of mention in passing is that her father is in an insane asylum. of sorts. So you don't know what the relationship was like between her and her father. So, yes.
She does say that she always dreamt of being hit.
Yes. Which
wonder, you know, if that relates to the relationship she may have had with her father. Like, we don't know.
Yeah, it's up for debate, isn't it? I mean, from what you can see of the relationship with her and her mother, she's definitely trying to rebel against her mother because her mother, as I mentioned, sort of really, really treats her like a child. So is always suspicious of her when she goes out. She doesn't know kind of what she's got up to. She assumes the worst. She assumes she goes around having sex with lots of men and things like that. So, and also it's quite interesting. So you talking about how the film is called, the book rather was called The Piano Player as opposed to Piano Teacher.
There's an
interesting kind of duality in two different groups of characters where you've got Erica and her mother, and the mother almost treats her like she's a child, and she almost, to her, bigs up all these sort of insignificant kind of concerts that she's doing, like she's playing in front of, you know, people at this recital in front of a small group of people, and this what is in effect a glorified school concert. So to her, it makes it up to a big deal. When she talks about it in public, she really downplays it. She does the complete opposite, almost to kind of almost humiliate her and sort of keep her sort of I don't know, if it was a normal relationship, you'd say under the thumb. That's not what I mean, per se, but it's something similar to that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. She, the mother, she's definitely very, very sour-faced, very reserved, when she's around other people. Both at home and, you know, outside the home, because we see the mother at the recital where Erica first meets Walter. We see mother at the concert, at the conservatory. And she's always, you know, very stern and, you know, not at all pleased. And we see Erica kind of oscillate between that, copying her mother exactly, and being, you know, a bit more kind, if you could say that, but then also being completely helpless and completely kind of lost in her kind of sexual perversions.
Yeah, which actually comes out a lot in the other relationship in the film, which is between her and Walter. So, which is definitely affected by the relationship between her and her mother. So, I've got to be honest, I'm not into, like, BDSM or anything like that. Sort of big confession here on the show. So it's a podcaster's confessional. So, yeah, I'm not really into any of that kind of stuff. So I don't feel...
You just want to clear the air.
Yeah, just to clear the air. I'm not into being tied up and hit and shit on or anything like that. That's not my bag. Sorry, everybody. But the character in this film... It's quite interesting as to how you think maybe she would have become that way, because possibly did the father sexually abuse her? Because that's not said, but from what I've read up, there are a lot of instances where people who have kind of, what's the best way I can describe it? Dysfunctional, I guess is the best way, maybe not exactly the right words, sexual taste. So in the film, for example, what happens is she goes to a porn store or like a porn theater,
like
type
a peep
thing.
Show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she watches porn, and at one point she doesn't seem to be getting off on it per se, but she would inhale sort of the used tissue from like the previous person who is in the stall, which is not very nice, I can imagine.
Nice.
There's a scene where she goes to like a drive-in cinema and she spies on a young couple having sex, and the way that she kind of again gets off is by urinating right next to the car, which again is very, very strange. And then yes, there's the whole thread of how the relationship develops between her and Walter, and then as it turns out, she, because she has this very kind of submissive relationship with her mother, and that's why she has this kind of cold exterior with kind of everyone else, with all her students. She's very much a perfectionist. She's very, very sexually repressed, so she can't express herself. When she meets Walter, it's almost like her way of kind of acting out all these things that she wants to do to kind of almost get back at her mother, like being tied up. She even mentions in her note, because one of the big aspects of the plot is that you know, her and Walter don't have like a conventional kind of sexual relationship. He wants to have a conventional sexual relationship, but she doesn't.
Oh, Walter.
Yeah, poor guy. And what she does is she writes a letter, which essentially she tells him to sort of tie her up and blindfold her and gag her and hit her and things like that, and to say, don't worry about my mother, I think. So I can't remember the exact words that she used, but it's to the effect of like, oh, my mother doesn't matter, just ignore my mother. So how do you feel about that? I mean, because it's quite interesting. I mean, just to give you some time to think. I mean, basically, you brought up something quite interesting. So you mentioned how in the scene where Walter is sort of doing his audition, how she kind of rejects him outright. But I think that she finds him attractive even at that point. And she kind of knows that she finds him attractive. So what she tries to do is almost tries to sabotage herself in that, trying to make him, I don't know, to say like, oh, I don't want him to be my student. And, you know, try and convince these other professors that, no, I don't want him. I think he's arrogant. And I think, you know, we can't help him. He knows too much already.
Yeah.
And the histrionics. When she isn't able to do that, that's when she sort of lashes out on herself by, you know, self-mutilating.
Yeah, which she sort of does throughout the film, up until the very final scene, where she literally stabs herself.
Yeah.
So, I don't think she dies.
Well, as I said, it's very, very open-ended.
It is.
In the book, she doesn't die. In the book, it's just meant to be a way to, again, sort of sabotage herself. So if you notice, she sort of stabs herself in the shoulder. It's not as if she stabs herself in the heart or in the stomach or anything like that. It's deliberately... It's deliberately the shoulder.
Sorry, I don't know where I'm going with this.
Or in the ear.
No,
or in the tongue. She doesn't stab herself in the tongue. No. As I said, she deliberately stabs herself in the shoulder. And some people have taken that as she's trying to almost sever the nerves in her arm so she can't play the piano, in the same way that she sabotages Anna, who is her student, and who is kind of like a... In the novel, I say it's very different, but in the film, it's almost as if she's almost like a copy of Erica, and Erica sabotages her initially because in the film it appears as though like she's jealous that like Walter is like being affectionate towards her, not in like a sexual way, but almost in like a supportive way. And she lashes out by sort of breaking the glass and putting it in her pocket so that she'll cut her hand and she won't be able to play, so therefore she won't be around Walter. But it's almost as if it's her way almost of saying like, well, you know, you don't want this life for yourself. You don't want to be some failed piano player like I am. So I'm going to give you the out.
I haven't thought of it that way at all.
It was on the DVD, again, plug for the DVD, Isabel Huppert herself said that as an interpretation of that scene. She thought it wasn't explicitly said, but she thought it might have been a reason why the character would have done that.
How interesting. Well, Erica definitely has trouble receiving affection of any nature because... she's quite terse with her colleagues who seem complimentary of her professional qualities. She's quite distant with a musician colleague with whom she's rehearsing for something. Do you remember the one that says, "I love lying in the name of love," where they pretend to be practicing Mendelssohn, but actually she's going to the drive-through cinema and waiting for the final screening in order to spy on couples that might be having sex in their cars. Do you remember that? Lovely, yeah, yeah. Lovely bit. Yeah. So she's quite, I mean, the relationship with the mother is very up and down, from outright declarations of love to actual physical fights. But she's also quite, she does show some affection for Anna. She does sort of soften a little bit when, you know, before she mutilates her, she actually shows, you know, kindness and understanding, where she tells the baritone off for putting more pressure on her and sort of being quite encouraging towards her. But then when she sees Walter also being encouraging towards her and supportive, that's when something snaps in her and she mutilates Anna. So it's almost like the people that she cares about or has some sort of affection for, she immediately kind of just snaps the other way and tries to hurt them. And actually Walter repeatedly says, "Why do you hurt me? You're hurting me. Why do you want to hurt me?" So he's very aware of that from the start. And we sort of see him, we see his character go on quite a journey from being kind of this playful, cheeky, you know, good looking, but, you know, boyish good looks. He becomes almost, you know, older and in some way kind of tainted and soured and cruel, in response to Erica's desire to both assert control, but also be, you know, but also submitting to him and having him hurt her, which is sad, because I think he's quite a likable character. Do you think he is? At the start, certainly he is.
Yeah, so at the start, like you say, he's quite sort of boyish, and this is, like I mentioned earlier, like Haneke likes to subvert genre tropes, so in a more conventional film, it would be sort of a typical sort of courting sort of story where, yeah, this guy tries to, you know, win over the heart of the main character, and then eventually she will fall in love with him, and then, you know, they will go off, and then whatever would happen in the rest of the story would happen. In this, however, it's very, very different. So in effect, what happens is, yes, there is sort of a conventional wooing of sorts, but unfortunately Erica is not a conventional person, and so he doesn't necessarily get what he wants out of the relationship to start with. So although she thinks he is capable of love, I think he is only really looking for, like, almost like a one-night stand type thing. So he'll tell
her. Do you really think so?
Well, I think so, because, I mean, I get, maybe it's because I'm a guy and I'm quite cynical of, like, how other men behave around women. But to me, it's like, well, you know, oh, I love you and things like that. So sort of all these pronouncements of love.
Okay. Wait, can I just stop you there? So you're telling me that this guy joins the Vienna Conservatory and passes a series of complex recital exams where he has to, like, learn however many 5 or 6 pieces of complex classical music by heart for the sake of a one-night stand? I mean, that's setting the bar quite high. And I mean, I know this is kind of Austria that we're talking about, so, you know, maybe... maybe the Austro-Hungarian temperament is still alive in Walter. But do you really think it's just for the sake of getting in her knickers?
Well, all right, maybe not a one-night stand. I think a one-night stand's probably like, that's not the best interpretation. But I think he's just out just to get whatever he can, essentially. I don't think he is 100% sincere. Yes, I get that he obviously goes to a lot of trouble to kind of woo this woman, but it's almost like the chase is more, you know, how with any courting, it's like with some people there'll be a lot of chase, and when you've got to the catch, you've actually got what you want, you kind of get bored and you're like, okay, great. So there's no kind of excitement there anymore and you kind of move on because you get bored. I think...
Are you speaking from personal experience here?
not really, I've got to be honest. But...
Since this is a Valentine's special, you know, we might as well lay our cards on the table, Greg.
Yeah, I can't say I've done that myself. I've definitely not joined a music conservatory just to woo a potential suitor.
But you're a musician. You you play bass, don't you?
I have, yes. At you one have point done. In my life, yes. That was something I
and
did.
Did that not, you know, did the rock and roll lifestyle not... you know, bring the women or?
It did once, one very memorable experience, but I won't go into that on the air.
Oh, but you must.
I can't. Sorry. It's, yeah.
Oh, I see.
I'm sure the listeners aren't that interested. But yes, I mean, look, bring it back to the film as quickly as possible.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's quite, yeah. I mean, you know, Austro-Hungarian temperaments abound. But I think it's more than that. I mean, I've seen this film twice. I saw it quite recently before we watched it now. And the first time I saw it, I actually didn't like Walter. So the mother refers to him as a leech. And we actually hear Erica using the same word later on in the film, where she kind of mirrors her mother's negative attitude towards Walter. I actually thought he was quite annoying, actually. At the start, I thought he was very... I thought he was overconfident. And he certainly is overstepping the mark, because if you listen to the French, he sort of very quickly... He pretty much calls her Erica from the start, not Professor Coat or Professor or whatever. He's on first name terms with her from the very start, whereas she continues to call him Monsieur Clemer until pretty much the very bitter end, doesn't she? And she refers to him as vous, so like the polite you, whereas he's like tu, Erica, tu, you know, he's very quickly blurring the, you know, he's very quickly challenging the hierarchical relationship that they are in by definition. He is younger, she's older. She is his teacher later on and he is the student, and he's kind of fighting against that constantly. And so you almost understand why she's been a bit defensive, because he has been quite confrontational at first.
Yeah, he's a bit of a cocky little shit.
He's a bit of a, what you said, he is a little bit, isn't he? He's a cheeky chappy.
He's a lad, way.
He's not, I mean, no, he's not though, really. Because he's, no, he's too bourgeois, but you do get a sense of his laddishness when he plays ice hockey. And do you think that actually the ice hockey and his, you know, the group dynamics when he's sort of on the ice, do you think that gives us a clue to his character? Because he does act quite laddish towards her, towards the end.
Yeah.
When she sort of seeks
that's
him
when
out.
He's around his ice hockey buddies. Though Buzz, he's just playing up yeah. in front of them.
Him and his
Although,
jock
what
strap.
I was going to say is the relationship does sort of go in a very unconventional way. So yeah, at the start, it is very much him wooing her. And then once we get to the point where they do have their first sexual encounter, which is in the sort of public toilet, sort of at the auditorium, it then becomes very, very much a power play. And how the power play works, I think, is very, very interesting. So what my interpretation of her character is that she wants to, basically she wants to be controlled by someone else. That's what we find out. But she doesn't necessarily want to give way to start off with. So so he wants to just, you know, have just sex in the toilets or whatever, and wants to have like normal sex, but she won't let him. So she does. So she uses like orgasm denial, which is what it's something that people do in like a BDSM type relationship. It's like a control thing. That's because it's interestingly, BDSM isn't necessarily about sex, it's about control. So what she tries to do is she tries to control him by, you know, not letting him come finish, you know, come to a climax. That's what I wanted to say. Which, as I can attest, is very, very painful, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So
she does
that.
This is like a crash course in BDSM for you Valentine's lovers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Don't let him come.
So, no, no. Having said that, and I mean, I don't want to seem obvious here, but don't you think that a lot of what this film is about is how sex that is divorced from love becomes, by definition, a destructive force?
I don't know necessarily.
Because I don't think Haneke is judging people for having unconventional, you know, desires or needs.
No, he's been quite sort of clear as to the fact he's not judging his characters.
He's not, but then we are led to judge the characters for their cruelty, for their inability to connect, to love, to accept affection and to give it. Don't you think that that is where, you know, the worm lies? That those desires are, they are the result of not being able to receive and give affection in a more conventional way, for whatever reason. Because let's go back to what you said, like Walter just wants to see what he can get. He you know, he's got quite straightforward linear needs. He says he's in love with Erica, whatever that means. Certainly the quality of his attraction towards her is quite romantic. It's quite sort of, you know, old world wooing, complimenting, using a soft voice to say pleasant things, whispering sweet nothings, that sort of thing. How does the quality of his feelings for her change as he is faced with her inability to accept that affection?
I think, I can be completely wrong, but I think it's interesting in how you kind of interpret the penultimate scene, where it's like almost like a home invasion in and of itself, where he goes back to their house for like a, or flat rather, for a second time. So the first time is where kind of he finds out that she has, you know, all these kind of desires that he maybe doesn't feel that he can reciprocate. So all the kind of weird stuff. And then that leads to them having the very, very awkward graphic, although greatly shot. I love that scene. So at the ice hockey rink, which is like an 8-minute unbroken take, where, again, it's her now being the one pursuing him, and then they don't even have penetrative sex. She basically gives him a blowjob, but then she throws up afterwards. Maybe because
this is a great date movie.
Well, she throws up afterwards, but again, it could be that she doesn't know kind of how to have sex because she's so infantilized. So because of the porn that she's watched, she kind of only knows it from watching porn, so she doesn't know what it's like really and things like that. So she could be a virgin, and her cutting herself on her vagina is a way of her losing her virginity as such. That could be one way of looking at it. And then when he then is very aggressive to her, and he starts, you know, comes back to the house, and then he starts hitting her, and he puts her mother in a room, locks the door so that she can't get out despite her protestations, and yeah, hits her to the point that her nose starts bleeding and she's got a black eye, and then in effect he kind of rapes her, which is sort of what it is really. Is that,
but all the while he's asking her to reciprocate, to like, you know, I will give you what you wanted, because this is, he's following the instructions that she wrote in the letter. He's literally quoting the letter as he is doing it.
Yeah, there's a line that she actually uses earlier in the film where mm-hmm. she kind of is going through letter. She says, I want what you want, as in what you want, we want that as well, when that's not really the case. So it's kind of, again, it actually might even be about communication and how if you've got two people who aren't suited for each other sexually, how maybe both sides try to compromise and that maybe doesn't work out. So he kind of literally starts hitting her and he rapes her because, well, this is what you want, isn't it? You said in your letter, literally, this is what you want. And maybe she doesn't actually want that, or maybe she does want that and it's just all play acting, I guess. It's hard to judge. And then when you've got the scene of her sort of with the knife, you assume that, well, she's gonna kill Walter. And then he kind of brushes her off, you know, doesn't register anything about that's what's happened. Is that because, and then what happens after that? Is that because she's disappointed, or is she angry at him? Or it's hard to say. It's so ambiguous. So
my reading of the knife was completely different. I thought, okay, this is my reading. So obviously the final sex scene is quite ambiguous because you don't know whether she's the victim or she's, you know, willing because that's what she asked for and now that's what she's getting. And what she's not giving him is the affection that he was asking for, because all the while he's kind of like, meet me halfway here. I'm being rough, but can you be gentle with me? And she just like completely zones out and becomes this like wax figure, which is quite disturbing, you know? And you're like, well, I'm not sure. Like, I feel so sorry for both of them. And this is gross. Like, why am I watching this? This is a horrible date movie. But then the next morning we see her and her mother all dressed up to go to the concert, to leave the house. And we see her packing a huge knife into her purse. And I thought that meant that she was scared. So you're like, oh yeah, she is a victim. Like, this is clearly like a PTSD thing. You know, because quite often, you know, women who have been attacked, they have an urge to protect themselves, to carry a weapon, to make sure that they can reciprocate, you know, next time, you know, should it happen again. So you're like, oh, she's definitely a victim. Okay. She's scared of him. So to me, like when she stabs herself, which I completely do not remember from the last time I watched this. I literally watched this like 2 months ago and I completely do not remember her stabbing herself. It was like so disturbing that I just completely blanked out. Yeah, like when she stabs herself, you're like, whoa, I get it. She's a victim, but she's a victim of herself rather than of him.
It's a facial expression that she makes as well, I think, when she does it.
That's just Isabelle Huppert, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Now, it's quite interesting that you mentioned it's like, oh, this is a horrible date movie. So yes. I think it's a good place to kind of sort of wrap up the film and kind of sum up sort of what we think about it. So overall, would you, as a film, would you recommend the film or would you not recommend the film?
I would recommend it. Plus, it's on 1001 Movies, so it's non-negotiable, really.
Oh, wow. As someone who's watched all 1001 of those films, I can tell you not all of them are good. It's not the 1001 best movies of all time. It's the 1001 movies to
Blonde
see before
Cobra.
You... Yeah, that movie's Tongues fucking
Untied.
Terrible. Yes. Say no more. but yes, I would also recommend the film. I think it's very good. It's not my favourite Haneke movie, as I said, but it would definitely make it in my top five. Yeah, my top five in no particular order because I can't, you know, it's hard to sort of rank them sort of off the cuff. But say The White Ribbon, Cachet, Piano Teacher, Seventh Continent, and then More or Funny Games, I would say. Kind of those 5/6 would kind of make it in mine. So yes, I do highly recommend the film. we're making out that possibly, I mean, from what anyone listening to this might think, is that it's a very gratuitous movie, but it really isn't at all. It's quite detached in that way, as I mentioned earlier. So it's not horrible. At least I didn't find it horrible anyway, but as we've established on this show, say my what's the best way to think of it? Basically, it's very difficult to shock me. Let's put it that way. So, and speaking of that, so as a date movie, so would you say it's a good date movie or a bad date movie? Because we have the following in this film, not to make it sort of a checklist, but we have domestic violence.
Check.
Porn. Check. Like actual porn. You can see everything. You've got genital mutilation, sort of self-harm.
Check.
You've got a scene which is sort of incest, but not really if you read the film correctly.
Oh, God. Yeah, that scene. Check.
Yes, you really didn't like that, did you?
I did not, no.
No. You've got multiple scenes of fellatio, or kind of other sex acts that are not sort of penetrative sex itself. And then in the last sort of 10 minutes or so, you've got full-on man-on-woman violence, and you've got rape and possible suicide, and you've got, as I mentioned, various sort of masochistic acts and discussion of BDSM sort of topics and things of that nature. So is it a good date movie or a bad date movie?
This is the worst date movie.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's, all right, that's interesting. Okay, so we established not a good date movie. So,
not a good date
from
movie,
one to five, how bad a date movie is it?
Well, I have to say that the first time I watched this film, I just lost the will to live.
Oh, wow.
Afterwards, I was like, this film, this is not what I imagined. This is just soul destroying. But then about a month passed and I wanted to watch it again. And actually watching it now, I find it's a lot more life-affirming. Also having, you know, read up on Haneke, who actually insists that he is an optimist at heart. I would say a 4.5.
Ah, okay. You're not really allowed halves. Sorry. I have to insist.
Are you serious?
All right, I'll let you off because it's Valentine's Day, and I'm in a charitable mood. What can I say?
Thank you, kind sir.
That's all right. I do my best. I would honestly. So, given all the stuff that I mentioned earlier, yes, and the way the film has been put together is sort of quite austere in its style and things like that. And yes, you're as mentioned near the start of the show, Haneke does sort of force his audience to watch these uncomfortable things and almost be like a participant in the action itself. There's that aspect as well. I would give it a 3 out of 5. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a high 3 out of 5, but and the reason for that is, yes, a lot of the stuff that happens is, you know, on paper, the way that we're talking about it now, yes, it sounds really bad, but a lot of it is not in bad taste or anything like that. So there is artistic merit to it. So it's almost like the Salo defense. It's, yeah, so it's not there for shock's sake as such. You know, you're not seeing, you know, literal, you know, razor blade to sort of, yeah, that part of the body. It's not shown in great detail. Even the rape is sort of very tastefully done. It's clear what's going on, but as I said, it's not, you know, it's not the rape scenes in like I Spit on Your Grave or Irreversible or anything like that. And to be perfectly honest, as someone who, you know, has watched multiple Haneke films, I would say this is not the worst Haneke date movie at all, not by a long shot. There are way, way worse sort of Haneke films to watch on a date. This is still not a good date movie at all. I would definitely not choose to watch this on a date night or something like that. But yeah, it could be a lot worse. So, a 3.
Well, it depends if you're trying to get rid of your date or not. It's hard to follow it up. I mean, what is the definition of a good date movie? You know, one that makes you feel more intimate with your partner, you know, hopefully puts you in a kind of romantic disposition, makes you, I don't know.
Horny.
Yeah. This film does not do that. It just does not do that.
It might do for some people. Not me.
No, but do you want to be on a date with that person?
There's a lot of sexually transgressive people out there.
Yeah, which brings me to my second Haneke quote of the episode, which I'm going to read out now. Pornography, it seems to me, is no different from war films or propaganda films in that it tries to make the visceral, horrific, or transgressive elements of life consumable. This film is definitely not trying to do that.
Oh, well, there you go. What more can you say other than that, really? Other than, if you wanted to buy this film on Blu-ray or DVD, so the DVD I own is from Artificial Eye. They have all of Haneke's films released under that label. That's Region 2. But if you want it on Blu-ray, it is available as part of the Criterion Collection. However, it's Region A only. So you need a multi-region Blu-ray player if you live outside of America. But yeah, if you want to own it, that's how you do that. I recommend owning it because, as I mentioned earlier, physical media is fucking great. So have at it.
Are you allowed to? Oh, yeah, you're allowed to swear because it's your podcast.
Yeah, it's my fucking podcast. Of course I'm allowed to swear. What do you think that you're not allowed to swear? Do you think I'm going to get fired for swearing on, like, iTunes or something? Come on now.
You've already been fired for swearing.
I've been fired for swearing radio, twice, so. Either, you know. Twice. You know, so, yeah.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah, it's
again.
Great. Well, it can't happen. I mean, yeah. Let's not push our luck. Swearing's fine. So on that note, if you want to recommend any more really terrible fucking date movies, doesn't have to be Valentine's Day related or not, you can do so on my Twitter at Worst Date Movies. Hit me up on there and suggest what horrible films that I should watch for your entertainment. And Muro, the floor is yours. Plug your, you got quite a lot going on, haven't you?
Greg, it's been such a pleasure to co-present the Worst Date Movies Ever podcast. I really enjoyed this, both as a guest and as a woman. I feel it's very important, you know, on Valentine's Day,
yes,
to talk about sexual transgressiveness from both the male and the female perspective. I'm based in Kiev. I'm to be found at the Triptych Gallery on Kiev's Andriyevskaya Vis most days. We're open 11 till 7 and we've got new exhibitions every 2 weeks. So when you're in Kiev, if you're in Kiev, hit me up.
Awesome. And thank you very much. And I hope you have a very, very pleasant Valentine's Day. And I only have one more episode left to go of this series. This is the first series of Worst Date Movies Ever. And yeah, on the very, very next show, it will be the last of the current series. So I'm really looking forward to doing that with you. And I'll catch you on the next show.